thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Seth M. Siegel, entrepreneur and activist on water issues. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own, not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. There is a sense among many Jewish community leaders today that the American Jewish world is in crisis. They just don't agree on what that crisis is or where it comes from, and certainly not how to fix it. Is the major issue for American Jews that anti-Semitism is rising here and around the world? Is the major issue that American Jewish institutions are too tied to supporting Israel blindly, no matter what? Is the core of the problem that younger Jews don't support Israel enough or don't feel a real connection to it? Is the key challenge for American Jews that this generation of young adult Jews and the previous one aren't nearly as likely to join organizations, synagogues, JCCs, and so on, as older generations? Is the central issue of American Judaism the prevalence of intermarriage? Is the biggest problem the cult-like popularity of Chabad, with its everything is free and everybody's welcome official line, combined with super-aggressive fundraising? Is the key issue that the large majority of Jewish children are not receiving any kind of formal Jewish education? Or are the larger problems of American society and the world's problems, global warming, economic inequality, homelessness, severe weakening of societal bonds, incivility, mass shootings, abortion issues, war in Europe, and other severe challenges, are these all more important than the success or failure of the American Jewish community's institutions? Well, I don't profess to have all the answers to how to solve the issues that arise, because many people don't like the direction of the American Jewish community. Obviously, things are changing and evolving. But of course, things always change. In fact, that's the very definition of life. Things that don't change are dead. The American Jewish world has always been dynamic, and while it hasn't always grown, it certainly has constantly changed. I don't personally believe that things are dire or disastrous or in any way seriously bad right now for American Judaism. But things are changing. And simply doing things the way we've done them for the past 20 years, or even 10 years, is unlikely to address the needs and interests of today's Jews or tomorrow's. We will always have differences of opinion on important issues, especially large ones that face the Jewish world. Is the Israeli government now acting badly or poorly on important issues, like the judicial system's authority, or settlements on the West Bank, or fighting terrorism? How do we best reach young Jews in America and keep them active and involved? What is the best way to involve non-Jews who are active in the Jewish community? And of course, how do we fight anti-Semitism effectively? But look, the real solution for how to keep the Jewish world vibrant, active, and engaged in Judaism is quite simple. Do a really good job of making our synagogues and other Jewish institutions welcoming, interesting, and vital. Care about the members of your Jewish community. Treat each other with respect, kindness, and derech eretz, true civility, even when we disagree. Be creative and energetic in programs. Make Shabbat and festival services enjoyable and diverse. Feed people, Jews like food. Teach effectively from the amazing storehouse of Jewish wisdom and knowledge. Spread Judaism wide and far in the best ways that you can. Oh, and one more thing. Have fun doing all that. If you enjoy what you're doing, you tend to attract people to your synagogue or Jewish community center or outreach program. Of course, you need to be authentically representing Judaism in a meaningful way, but you must have fun doing it. Essentially, I believe that the changes we're seeing in the American Jewish world today represent not a crisis, but a challenge and a charge. The need to do what we do with commitment, dedication, and joy. That's not a bad thing at all, nor is it a looming disaster. But it certainly represents a great opportunity to renew and rejuvenate, in the best way, Jewish life in America. In that spirit, and to play us in this summer morning on Too Jewish, here's a song from Idan Reichel, Evan Al Evan, Stone on Stone. Nothing comes freely, we always have to build it.
תמיד זה אבן על אבן, שום דבר לא בא בחינם. עכשיו לצאת אל הדרך, לאסוף טיפות עד שיהיה לנו ים. תראה בסוף הוא יבוא, נמשיך ונחכה לו. רגע של אושר כזה שחיים בשבילו. רגע של אושר כזה שרצים לקראתו. ואל תפחד מהעצב, תמיד הוא ילך ושוב יעבור. אבן על אבן, מרגע עוד רגע, שום דבר לא בא בחינם. וגם לטעות זה בסדר, ואז לצאת שוב מחדש לעולם. גם אם יגידו שלא, נמשיך ונחכה לו. רגע של אושר כזה שחיים בשבילו. של אושר כזה שרצים לקראתו. ואל תפחד מהעצב, תמיד הוא ילך ושוב יבוא. אבן על אבן, של אושר כזה שחיים בשבילו. רגע של אושר כזה שרצים לקראתו. ואל תפחד מהעצב, תמיד הוא ילך ושוב יעבור. רגע של אושר כזה שחיים בשבילו. רגע של אושר כזה שרצים לקראתו.
That was Idan Reichel's song, Evan Al Evan. We have to build happiness, piece by piece. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Seth M. Siegel, is an entrepreneur, author, and activist. He is profoundly concerned about the way that water is misused in our world, and he's doing something about it. He has a solution with his company to one of the most severe problems when he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Seth Siegel. He is an accomplished serial entrepreneur, but has been working assiduously on the problem of water in this world for about a decade, maybe longer. His book, Let There Be Water, which we talked about here on Too Jewish, was a New York Times bestseller, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. He's been working on the incredibly serious problem of flood irrigation. Seth, tell us what that... First of all, welcome back to Too Jewish.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back. Since I saw your invitation, I remembered our first interview warmly.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about what flood irrigation is in the first place, for those of us who are not agriculturally oriented.
Well, I'll tell you something. Just by virtue of the fact that you're Arizonans, should make you highly aware of what it is, because it's a major... it's probably the major draw of water for your state. But I'll tell you first what it is, and then I'll tell you how it relates to Arizona. So I suspect most of your listeners are either in the greater Tucson area or certainly in the state of Arizona. But if I'm wrong about that, I can give examples from other places as well.
Sure.
But flood irrigation is a method that was started many, many thousands of years ago. For your listeners who remember their fifth grade or eighth grade social studies class about ancient civilizations, the ancient civilizations realized that by diverting water from the Great Nile River or from the Tigris or Euphrates rivers into a series of canals, they could use that water to grow crops, but they couldn't have any precision in the way that they would divert that water. So they would flood the fields, and then the water would, over time, evaporate, or a day or two or five would evaporate, and some of the water would just seep into the ground. And then they would flood it again and again and again. And, you know, depending upon what kind of crop it was, they would keep flooding it until they were ready to harvest the crop. Now, that, as I said, was being done in antiquity. But strangely enough, that is still today the dominant form of irrigation. 85% of global irrigation is done by flooding fields. And we think of that maybe as, oh, well, like third world countries or developing world. But no. In Arizona, 89% of all irrigation that is done in your state, which is basically all of agriculture, is being done by flood. And that sometimes that's water that comes from the Colorado River. Sometimes that's water that's pumped out of groundwater resources. But in any event, it's a horrifically unsustainable technology because of the water waste. Now, until just a few years ago, there was really no choice. If you wanted to grow crops of any kind, you wanted to grow food or food for animals or fiber, like cotton, you had no choice. You would either flood or you would have to spend a fortune of money on some other irrigation technique. About a handful of years ago, an Israeli genius named Uri Shani, a professor, a former senior government official, a former head of the Water Authority of Israel, he had been thinking for 30 years about how wasteful flood irrigation is. And he kept thinking, I need to find a solution. Now, there already is something called drip irrigation, also invented in Israel. But drip irrigation is a wonderful technology. But the problem with it is it's expensive to install, and it requires extremely clean water, nearly tap water clean water. So it has to be purified before it can go into the system. And then you need a great deal of energy to propel the water across the field, so there's ongoing energy expenses. Now, 65 years ago when that was invented, and I write about drip irrigation at some length in my book, Let There Be Water, 65 years ago when it was invented, energy was a very low-cost item. People weren't thinking about climate change-type issues, but now those are very much front and center. So a farmer who has a commodity crop, something like alfalfa or sorghum or cotton or one of a dozen or dozens of other crops, but not wine grapes, not tree nuts, not avocados, you know, not the high value added crops. But farmers have commodity crops who want to wean themselves from flood irrigation now finally have a choice with a product that comes from an Israeli company called N-Drip, like new, N for new hyphen drip. And this technology takes flood irrigated fields using the gravitational slope of the field and zero, none, no external energy whatsoever. And it allows the, using the gravitational slope of the field to propel the water across the field. And as an added benefit, the system can work with any kind of water from dirty to clean. So it doesn't need to be filtered beforehand. So there's no external energy load needed. It's very inexpensive to install, easy to maintain, and this is a game changer. If there are 832,000 acres right now in Arizona that are flood irrigated, my hope is, and by the way, and 600 million across the world, and about close to 40 million in the United States at large, my hope is that someday very soon, everybody will stop flood irrigating and switch to Entrip, so that we can have a much more robust water future. I'll say one more word. Of course, everybody's reading a lot about the water cuts from the Colorado River state. There are some 6 million acres that are currently flood irrigated along the Colorado River and the Colorado River state. So if you could convert those, you could have all the water you need for Lake Mead. You would never have the problems that you're talking about right now. You'd need none of the cuts. Everybody take long showers, water their lawn, and do whatever they want to do if you just fix the problem of flood irrigation in agriculture.
We will talk much more with Seth Siegel all about water, really, when we come back here in a moment on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah study at 9 a.m., and services at 10 a.m., or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school registration is going right now for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us for our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night, Saturday morning, or come on our Facebook page for services or attend our Torah study and all of our wonderful Adult Education Academy classes, either in person or on Zoom. Access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetcher, kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are helpful. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation.
known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, I've just come back from Portugal, where I had, first of all, a lovely time, and was looking for Sephardic heritage there. And, you know, like in Spain, a lot of times you can find some elements of 500-year-old Judaism, but it's mostly subsumed. But there's a current expression of Judaism, and there's a big Chabad house in Porto, and there's some Jewish synagogues, but they're not really connected to the Sephardic past. That's not unusual in places where there's new Jewish life. And I hesitate to call it a revival because you suggested it might be off mic, it might be a transformation, but I think it's almost like a new expression in a place that has a great Jewish heritage, but not always connected.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question because I think the question of the renaissance or revival of some of these old Jewish communities varies enormously from one place to another. I think each one has its own tale to tell. And it depends on who's doing the reviving and what the starting point was. So I'll give you two sort of extreme examples that both happen to be in the former Yugoslavia. A country that I once knew very well, when there was still Tito, and when, you know, Jewish life was never outlawed to the degree that it was in the former Soviet Union, but it was discouraged, particularly as it was often interpreted to imply a dual loyalty to Israel and the former Yugoslavia. So, like, things like Israeli dancing and singing, which are part of American Jewish life, almost no matter what movement of Judaism you're talking about, disappeared from the former Yugoslavia. But Jews did not. They often went into the closet. They often intermarried. There are a lot of people who identify as Jews in in the former Yugoslavia who have one Jewish grandparent. But let's look at two Jewish communities that we've talked about before, but in this light, on this particular question. So there's a very old, very significant Jewish community in Sarajevo, which is the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it was largely founded by Jews who were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula and who settled there under the Ottomans upon the invitation of the Ottoman rulers, and who made Sarajevo a rich, cosmopolitan, diverse city, and who generally had good relations with both their Muslim neighbors and their Christian neighbors. And the Christians themselves were divided between Orthodox and Roman Catholic. So it wasn't a Catholic country like Croatia, where Jews had a much harder time. But gradually, mostly because of the Shoah, and then because of Aliyah, people who decided to move to Israel to build their future after the war, mostly that Jewish community disappeared. There was always something. There were always services in one old synagogue, and in the oldest and biggest and most impressive synagogue, they built a Jewish museum. But the community dwindled slowly, and it has revived. There's not Chabad presence there, so there's no like foreign version of Judaism. The truth is, though, that when it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire prior to World War I, a lot of Ashkenazic Jews settled. So there are people with Germanic-sounding or Hungarian-sounding family names. But there are also the old Spanish family names like Alcalay, Elazar, Cabillo, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, the names they brought with them from the Iberian Peninsula.
Right. And so people with names like that never completely forgot their Jewish origins, no matter what their level of observance was. And now there's an influx of Jews with origins in Bosnia-Herzegovina, particularly in Sarajevo, who are like coming back from Israel or coming back from other parts of the Bosnian diaspora, Canada, the U.S., whatever. They're returning home, and they're really reviving Jewish communal life. So the numbers of Jews in Sarajevo are growing slowly but surely. And I'll bring this to an end very quickly with an example that I think I shared with you once before. When I worked in Vienna for an international organization, I met a colleague named Daniela Cabillo, and she looked Austrian, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, whatever. And I said, Daniela, are you from Sarajevo? She said, no, but my husband is. How did you know? So your name is Cabillo. And she gave me this big smile, and it was like, you know, for her, it was clear that she and her husband were Jewish no matter what they did. And there's a sense of a proud Jewish identity and greater engagement and activism in Sarajevo without a Chabad presence at all.
Well, I want to explore this question a little further for some other examples in other places next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi is giving his sermon, as was his unfortunate custom. He droned on and on and on. Finally, he realized he had more than tried the patience of his congregation. He looked up and apologized, saying, I'm sorry for going on so long. You see, I left my watch at home. A congregant called out, but Rabbi, you have a calendar right there in front of you. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the great final book of the Torah, Dvarim, or Deuteronomy, also known as Mishneh Torah. The people of Israel have arrived at the very borders of the Promised Land. Our great leader, Moses, begins a long sermon, three actually, that will carry us forward through the entire book of Deuteronomy. If you thought some rabbis' sermons were long-winded, try this. Moses' first speech in Deuteronomy starts this Shabbat and doesn't conclude until next week. And that's by far the shortest of his sermons in Devarim. Our great leader Moses begins by employing that most Jewish of devices, guilt. God has led our people to the very borders of the Promised Land, taking care of all the Israelites' physical needs, worked wonders and miracles for them, and yet, repeatedly, they've failed to keep faith with God. Well, you know the story. After all, these are the children of Israel. They don't call, they don't write, they don't send birthday cards. In spite of all the love lavished on the Israelites, they've never really accepted God's presence. In spite of everything God's done, from miraculous salvation on the shores of the Sea of Reeds to the great revelation at Sinai, the 40 years of manna in the wilderness and so on, they remain ungrateful and unaware. And now, here at the very gateway to the promised land, they still don't get it. To correct this problem, or at least attempt to do so, in our portion of Devarim, Moses begins to lay out the Deuteronomic covenant. It forms the core of his last best effort to convince our people they should recognize God's presence and keep the faith. Remember, he says repeatedly, listen, hear my words, pay attention. God is with you. God cares. Have faith. In next week's portion of Vayetchanan, Moses will reach true eloquence. In a perfect phrase, he will make it all astonishingly clear. Hear, people of Israel, the Lord is our God, and God is one. Shema, listen, hear. What is hearing, really, but the auditory awareness of the presence, the voice of another? What is our task but learning how to listen for God's whisper in the world? The covenant we're given in Deuteronomy has a mixed reputation these days. It's a simple formula, really. If you believe in God and act ethically, you'll be rewarded. If you stray from God's mitzvot, you'll be punished. This form of divine covenant doesn't play so well today. It promises that good things happen to good people while bad things happen to bad people, which we know from our own experience isn't always or even so often true. But I'd suggest that a more profound reading of Devarim teaches us that Moses' real message, the ikar, the heart of his lesson, is that our fundamental failure is not doing immoral things and being punished for them. Instead, it's failing to be aware of God's presence in our world. That, of course, is something our ancestors struggled with repeatedly. When they saw great miracles enacted before their eyes, they managed to recognize God's hand in the world. Yet within a few days, as Moses reminds them in our portion of Devarim, they managed to forget that God had done much, or anything even, for them at all. As hard as it was for our ancestors to sense God's presence, it's perhaps an even greater challenge today. We are bombarded with information of all kinds by all kinds of devices. Email, TV, smartphones, texts, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and on and on. Today it takes something extra to be able to sense God's presence in the world. And yet, God is here, no farther away than before. God is in the intricate ways that life flourishes and changes, in the ways in which we and nature learn and grow. In the blush of new love, in the depth of lifelong devotion, in a child's laugh, in a bubby's hug, in a teen's first kiss, in the expanse of the universe, and in the small magical beauty of an unfolding blossom, in the thunder and lightning of a monsoon. Back in the 12th century, the poet and Torah commentator Ibn Ezra wrote, I see you, God, in the starry sky. I see you in a field of rye. In every leaf and every flower, there's witness to your matchless power. We fancy that you remain concealed, but in all your work you are revealed. And yet we walk easily or run through this world of wonder and miss God's presence. Devarim teaches that it is our central task to look and truly see, to listen and truly hear. On the week of the first portion of the final book of the Torah, and the week before the commemoration of Tisha B'Av, the fast day of the ninth of Av, a week from Wednesday night, may we all learn to listen and strive to see God's presence all around us. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Seth M. Siegel, explains the centrality of the scarcity of fresh water on Earth and the choices we have to make to preserve it and use it well, and how Israel is pioneering remarkable ways to do so. All that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In England, the BBC apologized for an on-air interview in which one of its anchors told former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, "Israeli forces are happy to kill children." The journalist, Anjana Gadgil, was interviewing Naftali Bennett last week about the IDF's incursion into the Palestinian West Bank city of Jenin. 12 Palestinians and one Israeli were killed in the operation, which lasted 2 days. Israel conducted the operation to root out terror cells in the city, and it maintains that all of the Palestinians who died, regardless of age, were terrorists. Near the beginning of the 8-minute interview, Bennett repeated that message, to which Gadgil responded, "Terrorists, but children. The Israeli forces are happy to kill children." Bennett responded, "It's quite remarkable that you'd say that, because they're killing us. Now, if there's a 17-year-old Palestinian that's shooting at your family, Anjana, what is he?" Gadgil's remarks drew condemnation from a number of groups and public figures. The British Board of Deputies, an umbrella community organization of the Jews, said it was appalled by her statement and that it would reach out to the BBC due to what it called a clear breach of the corporation's own guidelines. The Anti-Defamation League called the remarks slanderous and hateful and said it speaks to a sustained anti-Israel bias within mainstream media outlets. Bennett tweeted that the conversation was one of the most hostile interviews towards Israel that I can remember. In response, a spokesperson for the BBC told the Jewish Chronicle, the British newspaper of Jews, that the network apologizes for Gadgil's statement. "While this was a legitimate subject to examine in the interview, we apologize for the language used in this line of questioning. It was not phrased well and was inappropriate," the BBC said, adding that the network was endeavoring to cover Jenin in an impartial and robust way. The British Board of Deputies said it welcomed the speedy response from the BBC. "I am pleased the BBC have apologized for the clearly unacceptable language used in their interview with Naftali Bennett," said Marie van der Zyl, the group's president. The BBC's apology came about 6 weeks after CNN anchor Christiane Amanpour apologized for saying the killing of 3 British Israelis happened in a shootout rather than a shooting. Turns out that the new Barbie movie, one of the most hyped films of the summer, has a surprising number of Jewish connections. Some of that emerged last week when director Greta Gerwig said she wanted people who see the movie to feel the way that she did when she went to Shabbat dinners at an Orthodox friend's house as a child. "I remember feeling the sense of whatever your wins and losses were for the week, whatever you did or didn't do, when you come to this table, your value has nothing to do with that," Gerwig said of the Shabbos dinners. "I remember feeling so safe in that and feeling so like enough," she said. "I want people to feel like I did at Shabbat dinner. I want them to get blessed by the Barbie movie." Gerwig is not Jewish, but her partner and co-parent is Noah Baumbach, who is, of course, Jewish and was the lead writer on the Barbie screenplay. Jewish actress Rhea Perlman plays the doll's real-life Jewish creator, Ruth Handler. The Barbie movie is the first for Mattel, the toy company that Handler and her husband grew into an empire. Mattel has always closely guarded the Barbie brand, but under the leadership of the Israeli-born Inon Kreiz, who has served as the CEO of Mattel since 2018, it is loosening the reins and has embarked on more than 100 brand partnerships in conjunction with the movie, including the Israeli ice cream chain Golda. "Watch me dance, dance the night away. My heart could be burning, but you won't see it on my face. Watch me dance, dance the night away. I'll still keep the party running on one." Israel's national men's soccer team qualified for the Olympics for the first time in nearly 50 years because of its surprising run at a major under-21 European tournament. Israel lost to England last week in the semifinals of the UEFA European Under-21 Championship, a biennial contest among the continent's best U21 teams. But 3 days earlier, after a win in the playoff round against Georgia, Israel earned a place at the 2024 Paris Olympics alongside only 15 other countries. Soccer at the Olympics is an under-23 tournament, although each team is allowed 3 roster spots for players older than 23. Israel's competed in UEFA, Europe's umbrella soccer association, since the 90s because, well, being Israel, they were kicked out of the Asian Football Confederation. This tournament brought historic achievements to Israeli soccer. We reached the quarterfinal, then the semifinal. We qualified for the Olympics for the first time in 47 years, Moshe Shino-Zuarez, the chairman of the Israel Football Association, said after the loss to England. I'm proud of each and every one of our players, our staff, the whole delegation, for smashing every possible ceiling and restoring confidence in Israeli soccer. The U21 team's success follows the Israeli under-20s team's Cinderella run to a third-place finish at the FIFA U20 World Cup in Argentina last month, as reported on Too Jewish. That squad beat South Korea 3-1 in a third-place game at the end of a thrilling stretch that included wins over Uzbekistan, Japan, and powerhouse Brazil. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Seth Siegel is an entrepreneur, an accomplished businessman, a producer of Broadway shows, but in particular an activist on the subject of water. We talked earlier about this N-drip irrigation system. Let's take a step back for a moment and talk globally. People have heard plenty about global warming and the severe ecological crisis we seem to be working our way towards, maybe are already in the midst of. Can you put water use in that context a little bit for us?
Yeah, I sometimes say to to climate skeptical people that I'll meet, or even people who just, you know, they don't really understand enough about it, or they say, oh, I read in the newspaper it's going to really big effect in the year 2100 or 2050, and I'm probably not going to be alive then. I say, okay, fine. So I don't care if you're a skeptic about climate. That doesn't really matter. But let's not look about a tomorrow issue. Let's look at a today issue. And around the world, we're seeing climate change express itself, not just in temperatures, but in the change of water patterns. So I like to think of climate change as being most profoundly influenced by either too much water, flooding, or too little water, droughts. And the impact of that is not just that, okay, we can change what we do a little bit here, a little bit there. It's that if we don't change what we do. We're going to find ourselves with whole pockets of the world where the water is just going to give out, where millions, tens of millions of people are going to find themselves in severe, stricken communities, and they're not going to stay. They're going to pick up and they're going to move, and it's going to create a global humanitarian crisis of the dimension that we have never seen before. The best way to deal with immigrant flows is to encourage people to not move to new places unless it's done in an orderly way. And if you can make sure that people have food and water and job where they are much less likely to pick up and move. That's just human nature. But if you're telling them that their lives are at risk or their children's lives are at risk, they're going to pick up and move the same day and take all kinds of risks of the journey. So we need to fix our water problems everywhere so that we can be secure in our homes, in our own communities.
Israel has been a pioneer for a long time on water usage by necessity. Probably the most complete use of available water in the world takes place between Israel and its neighbors because there's such a shortage. Can you talk a little bit about that context?
Well, that's certainly the topic of my book, Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World, that you kindly mentioned at the start of the segment. Israel didn't start thinking about water when they already were running out of water. Israel started thinking about water before there was a state. In the 1920s, the then Zionist leadership, there was no Israel until May of 1948, the Zionist leadership understood that they needed to be expert at three things if the Zionist experiment or enterprise was going to succeed. They obviously had to be good at a lot of things. They had to have good hospitals and schools and things of that sort, and nice highways and roads and things that every society has. But they knew they needed to do three things very well. They knew they would have hostile neighbors, but they need to have a good defense. They knew they were going to have, or hoped they would have, large numbers of immigrants. So they knew they had to build out an immigrant absorption system. And they knew that everything would be at risk if they didn't figure out how to provide water for the immigrants who they hoped would come and to build out a robust economy. And so they began doing a whole variety of things, building out smart governance, developing water conveyances, and mostly encouraging technology to be introduced into the way they handle their water. So Israel has not only the most efficient water system in the world, it's also the most technologically advanced water system in the world. Israel is an extremely dry place. Two-thirds of the country is desert. It's in the driest region of the world. Israel has among the world's fastest growing populations as a percentage of its country. Israel is an exceptionally dynamic economy. And all of these should bespeak Israel as a water basket case. But it's the opposite, as you sort of hinted at in your question. Israel exports water to the Palestinians in the West Bank, the Palestinians in Gaza, and to the Kingdom of Jordan. And not small amounts of water, very large amounts of water. 60% of the household water consumed in the West Bank by Palestinians in the West Bank is from Israeli sources. So Israel is able to produce all the water that it needs because of these technological advances and because of all the smart ways they approach agriculture and municipal water and so forth.
In advocating for better water usage, for conservation, for drip irrigation, for example, to replace flood irrigation, there's a resistance to it, right? Getting people to change the way they do things is always challenging. Getting agricultural interests, which are, while financially driven, maybe even more conservative than other elements of society, to change is hard. What's the best way of going about it?
You know, generally speaking, I'm loath to involve government too much in our lives. I think there's a lot of that already, but it's not an ideological thing. I just think it's practically speaking, people do best when they have their incentives set off in front of them. But in the case of changing the way people behave, whether it's healthcare policy, whether it's education policy, whether it's water policy, there is an essential role for government to help shepherd in a new way of thinking about things. And I believe that the way that we are going to find the greatest success, and this is already happening significantly in Arizona. Arizona is wonderful in terms of their leadership. That there is an understanding that farmers will find their way to new technologies if they aren't forced into it, but if they are given an opportunity to try new things without it being very costly or very risky for them. So to take Entrip again as the example, Entrip is not terribly expensive, but even so, to say to a farmer, please pay for this, at first it's going to be hard. So government has a perfect role by saying, we will pay for pilot projects to show farmers how this works. This and other technologies, by the way, not just this. And we will give money to the farmer so that he or she or they can try this technology on their farms. And if it works, then obviously in later years, then it becomes less of a government burden and more of a private burden. And the reason why this is also important is because water is a common good, even though it's privately a private property in many places. Water is a common good. And so water that is saved, say, in Pinal County is the value in having more water in Pima County and likewise Maricopa County. This is something where it's not where the school system is good in one place, it's necessarily going to be bad in another place. This is a story where there's a finite amount of water available from the Colorado or from groundwater. And if we fix it, everybody is a beneficiary.
I want to thank Seth Siegel for a valuable and eye-opening visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your work and to find out more about water?
Well, first of all, I have a website, and I love when people contact me. I get a lot of inbound emails every day, so please feel free to write me at www.sethm, like Mary or Mordechai or Martin, Seth M. Siegel, and it's spelled S-I-E-G-E-L, .com, SethMSiegel.com. So contact me via my website. As I mentioned, spoke a bit about Entrip today. Feel free to go to the Entrip.com website, and you can learn more about the company there. Arizona is ground zero for fixing our water future. I can say, by the way, I'm an extremely optimistic person, and I believe that the crisis that we have in front of us will provide very, very good outcomes, and Arizona will become the model, the entire rest of America and the world, and how to use water efficiently and intelligently. I'm very, very optimistic that very good outcomes are coming.
Thank you so much, Seth.
And thank you. I'm delighted to be back, and please invite me for a third time.
Absolutely. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services at Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services in Kiddush. Live in person and available on our Facebook page. To play us out this morning, here's Yoni Z's newest song, a highly energetic one, Hakol Letova, all good. Count your blessings. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. שקט בלב לחש לי מבפנים כל העולם הוא קשר צר ויודעים שהעיקר לא לפחד כלל לזכור את האמונה מדי אבין רחמנה כי כל מה שקורה קמצו לטובה
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.